This is a Triple J podcast.
Prescription pills, it was alcohol, it was ice, it was G.
That may be the view of young people, it's not the view of our government.
If I don't meet a girl, it's pretty hard to tell her that I'm uncontactable.
To connect, to have a good time, to dance it off like nobody's watching.
This is going to have an effect for generations to come.
They've taken the world by storm, a new generation of weight loss drugs that are making people a lot of money. One manufacturer now worth more than $1 trillion. So how much bigger will the business of weight loss get? G'day, it's Dave Marchese with you for Hack. Later we are talking Mounjaro, Ozempic, Wegovy, how they're reshaping the way we eat. Also ahead, a bleaching event that's devastated coral off the coast of Australia. It's not the Great Barrier Reef, it's on the west coast. And locals are pretty frustrated more people aren't talking about it.
I speak for a lot of people here who feel like the reef is a part of them. It's just not getting the attention it deserves.
Yeah, that story is coming up very soon. First though,
Hack. For me, the reason why I get a prescription with medicinal marijuana is to help me with my life.
On Triple J.
If you take medicinal cannabis, I'm wondering what you do about driving. Like, how long do you wait before you get behind the wheel? Is it something you're thinking about a lot if you're impaired? It is worth talking about. We know drug driving deaths have now overtaken drink driving deaths in Australia. Medicinal cannabis, it was legalised in this country years ago, but have our laws kept up? Well, in a bit, we're going to ask an expert about the science behind cannabis and the impacts it has on us. But first, Alice Angeloni's been speaking with some medicinal cannabis users about their experiences.
I honestly don't think about it too much because the benefits I get from using my script outweigh that risk for me.
Charlie, not a real name, is in her 20s and lives near Coffs Harbour on the mid-north coast of New South Wales. She's prescribed medicinal cannabis for anxiety, but in New South Wales, it's an offence to drive with any trace of the psychoactive component of cannabis, known as THC, in your system. Which leaves Charlie with the question,
how are you meant to integrate it into your life?
It's something she's grappled with.
There's like not a lot of information on any of the sites of what to do if you were to get pulled over. They obviously tell you that you can't drive.
Do they give you an indication though of how long?
No, not really. Not really. Using? Yeah, it wasn't really in depth.
So that's meant Charlie has just kind of made up her own system.
So I kind of try to obviously pick times that I know I won't be driving in the morning. Maybe I'll give myself 12 hours.
She was given a patient card with her prescription.
Always just assumed like if I were to be pulled over, I could show my patient card if I were to do a random drug test.
Under current law in New South Wales, that's not actually the case. But in that state, one MP wants things to change.
I move that a bill be introduced.
In New South Wales, Independent State MP Alex Greenwich introduced a private member's bill to Parliament last month.
We're dealing with the reality that THC stays in a person's system much longer than after it can impair you.
The bill is aimed at providing a legal defence for medicinal cannabis users to drive with the drug in their system, as long as they're not high.
Across New South Wales, thousands and tens of thousands of people are having to choose between going to work, seeing a loved one, or taking their medication.
Alex Greenwich has also revealed he uses medicinal cannabis to treat severe anxiety and insomnia. Now he's advocating for others who need to use the drug on medical grounds but risk losing their license.
What this bill deals with is for those drivers who are driving safely, not impaired, but they just have some THC still in their system because they're simply following their doctor's advice.
A parliamentary inquiry into the regulatory framework for cannabis in New South Wales last year found cannabis in a driver's system doesn't necessarily mean they're impaired. It didn't make a specific recommendation, but
opposition MPs on the committee pointed to evidence from Transport for New South Wales that showed cannabis was the most common illicit drug in fatal crashes from 2019 to 2023.
When you see me all the time, I have taken cannabis within the last 24 hours.
Ben uses medicinal cannabis for chronic pain. He lives in a town southwest of Sydney and, like Charlie, driving is a risk he takes.
If I'm pulled over by the police today and they test my blood, it will be in my blood. It stays in there for up to 90 days.
But Ben has questions for the government on this because essentially he reckons the medicine that keeps him functional could also get him arrested. New South Wales is just the latest place to have this debate. Other parts of Australia have already debated on it. In Tasmania, and since March in Victoria, magistrates have the option to decide whether or not to cancel the driver's licence of a person who tests positive to THC and is using prescribed medicinal cannabis. And overseas? Well, 33 states in the US have effects-based driving under the influence of marijuana laws that criminalise a person for driving while they are truly impaired, as determined by an expert or by eyewitness testimony. Back to Charlie.
Is it a concern for you that you could get pulled over and...
Yeah, definitely, because I use my car every day for work.
She hopes the same protection will become available for her in New South Wales. And in the meantime, she says if nothing changes, she'll have to weigh up whether she should keep using medicinal cannabis at all.
It is so helpful for me to have access to it. And if they don't change the laws, then maybe I won't want to keep accessing that because I don't want to risk losing my licence, especially for work.
Hack on Triple J.
Alice Angeloni reporting there, and I should say the New South Wales government gave us a statement that says it will review advice from an expert working group on a legal defence for drivers taking medically prescribed cannabis, and that is due by the end of the year. All right, let's get into this a little more now because we're hearing from a lot of people on the text line actually who have thoughts on this, who maybe have some experience. Someone says, I don't smoke and drive, but even the next day when I'm not impaired, it still shows up in a test. There should be a way to measure the amount, not just whether it's there. Well, let's ask if that is possible. Dr. Danielle McCartney is an associate lecturer in pharmacology at the University of Sydney and is with us now. Dr. McCartney, thank you very much for joining us on Hack.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Is there any way of measuring how much a person's driving ability, for instance, could be impacted by cannabis?
So cannabis, including medicinal products, often contains THC. And as you say, yes, THC can impair driving performance. At the moment, police use oral fluid drug tests at the roadside to identify THC that might be present in a person's system. As you say, overseas, internationally, there are other behavioural tests that are used. As of yet, there is no perfect system for identifying cannabis-affected drivers at the roadside. Every system has some limitations.
Okay. Are people affected in different ways? Like, are some people more impacted by the impacts of THC than others?
Sure. So people who have used cannabis or THC on a regular basis do tend to develop tolerance, meaning that they can be less affected by the effects of cannabis. I guess the other divide that we talk about a little bit is the difference between recreational cannabis users and medicinal users. So it's not necessarily... To some extent, they might be affected differently, but we've also got to look at and consider their use patterns. So someone using cannabis recreationally might be doing it to experience intoxication, and you're more likely to see impairment with that. Whereas someone using it medicinally might be using lower doses. They're using it to control a medical condition that could otherwise affect driving, things like pain and insomnia. And they have usually developed some amount of tolerance to the effects of THC.
And are the impacts similar to the impacts of alcohol?
In that we see impairment in driving with both substances, I suppose you could say yes. The exact effects do differ somewhat, but I guess, that the ultimate thing that we need to be considering is whether or not there are road safety impacts. And so I guess they can differ in some respects, but... I've lost a little bit of the
question. Yeah, no, that's okay. I mean, it does sound like at this point there's not really a test that can tell you whether it's still safe for you to drive, regardless of whether or not you've got it in your system. The test might prove that you do have it in your system, but it's hard to tell from a test whether you might be impaired or not.
That's right. Oral fluid THC concentrations are not a reliable indicator of impairment, particularly in regular users, which medicinal cannabis users often are. There are also, difficulties with the behavioural tests in that we are still working on developing improved methods through research. Yeah.
Do you think then maybe laws are lagging behind in Australia at the moment, that there should be a really big focus on this?
Yeah, it would seem that laws are lagging behind. So medicinal cannabis has been legal in Australia since 2016 now, and we've seen no change in the legislation affecting driving in and around cannabis. And so we do have a situation now where patients using legal medicinal cannabis products cannot legally drive in most states of Australia because THC does persist in oral fluid and blood for extended periods of time. And we need to be looking at alternative methods of regulating this. You know, we have systems for other drugs that affect driving, opioids, benzodiazepines. These can all impact driving, and patients are currently trusted to use these medicines responsibly and drive when they're not impaired. And if they are impaired, you know, that's not acceptable. That is illegal still, and they will be charged with that. So we need to be looking at these systems for medicinal cannabis users.
Interesting stuff. Dr. Danielle McCartney from the University of Sydney, thank you very much for joining us.
No problem.
And we've got other messages coming through. Someone says there does need to be a way to measure the level, like RBT, and set a limit. Another person says, what if you take it in a capsule, swallowing it whole? We've got someone on the line right now. Cooper is with us. Cooper, you use medicinal cannabis. Is this something that you've been concerned about, how you might be impacted behind the wheel?
Yeah, it has been. Like, I never do it before driving, obviously, but I use it virtually every single night to help me sleep with chronic pain in my back and shoulders. So if I was to wake up early the next day to get to work or to commute to Sydney for whatever reason and I was pulled over, it would be a loss of license for a green tea plater easily.
Yeah, is it something you think a lot about, just considering how much you are using medicinal cannabis? Like, it sounds like it's something that's really important in your life.
Yeah, it was a lot more stressful at the start when I first started using it medicinally, because I did it casually beforehand, as most Australians do when they're younger, but I got onto it purely to relieve some of that anxiety, and it worked for that aspect. But nowadays it's kind of just like, because I'm so used to it, if it was to happen to me, it would be almost as if it was coming the whole time.
Yeah. Oh, well, look, thank you very much for sharing that with us, Cooper. There's other people who also have concerns taking medicinal cannabis. Someone says, I was taking medicinal cannabis, but I'm on parole and now I have to stop taking it because I'm worried about breaking the law and going to jail. There are people with all kinds of scenarios here, people asking about what other countries do around the world. We'll stay on this one, but we've got to move on for now.
Hack.
Every time we come into a summer now, we're finding that everything is just getting slightly warmer and warmer and warmer every year.
On Triple J.
Yeah, when we talk about coral bleaching, chances are you automatically start thinking about the Great Barrier Reef, which is fair enough. It's one of the seven natural wonders of the world. But the truth is, there's another heritage-listed reef that's been devastated by coral bleaching recently on Australia's west coast, the Ningaloo. There's some recent research found nearly two-thirds of coral in one section of the reef had died. And locals are pretty frustrated that it's not getting more attention. Our WA reporter Jackson Worthington has more.
We see manta rays. We get to spend some time in the water with some sharks as well. So we have a specific place, which is a grey reef shark cleaning station, which is really, really unique. And we also spend time in the water with tiger sharks.
Don't forget turtles.
Sorry, and turtles. I forget turtles.
Yeah, we have. Ayla and Fraser usually spend their days on the boat doing tours off the coast of Coral Bay. Ayla is a deckhand and photographer, and Fraser is her boss.
We also actually get loggerhead turtles on an area we call the Sand Flat. So we have a resident we call Albert.
Coral Bay is about 12 hours north of Perth and it's considered one of the southern gateways to the Ningaloo Reef. The Ningaloo is a World Heritage listed reef, which is renowned for its animals like whale sharks and manta rays. But lately, it's been making headlines for a different reason.
This marine heatwave, it's like an underwater bushfire raging along the Western Australian coast.
Earlier this year, a marine heatwave hit the reef. It caused mass coral bleaching. Coral bleaching happens when reef systems are put under too much stress. Essentially, the coral expels the algae, which gives them colour, causing them to turn white. Large parts of the reef were impacted by what some called an underwater bushfire. In Coral Bay, Ayla and Fraser watched firsthand as the corals turned white. Now, about 6 months after the heatwave, they're watching the colour come back, and they want people to know it's important they still come and visit.
A lot of the science research, we couldn't do it without tourism.
But 2 hours north of Coral Bay, off the coast of Exmouth, the situation looks pretty dire.
I wish I had good things to say, but unfortunately, yeah, we have seen quite a steep decline in the health of the reef since the bleaching.
Brooke Pike is an underwater photographer and tour operator who lives in Exmouth. She spends a lot of time diving the reef.
I think I speak for a lot of people here who feel like the reef is a part of them, and seeing it suffer like this is very shocking. And I feel like it's just not getting the attention it deserves.
The reality on the reef is really different in Coral Bay and Exmouth, but people in both towns want more done to protect it.
I often feel like the Ningaloo is very out of sight, out of mind. This does get swept under the rug quite easily.
If we don't have policies in place to manage what people do in terms of pollution and fishing, which are the two big ones, then we're not giving the reef the best chance to recover.
Our primary tool is marine parks.
Dr. Tom Holmes is the program leader of the marine science team at the Department of Biodiversity, Conservation and Attractions in WA. His team monitors the health of marine ecosystems right along the WA coast. They usually survey areas once every 3 years, but made an extra trip to the Coral Coast this year after the marine heatwave.
It's been a tough year, I think, for everyone who either lives in these locations or, you know, like myself, who have spent a large period of their life studying it and visiting it on a very regular basis. But you can't turn up to work every day and do this without having a degree of hope for the future.
Dr. Holmes reckons the heatwave that hit the Ningaloo this year is worse than anything that has hit the Great Barrier Reef off Queensland. He says it's hard to know how long the reef will take to recover, particularly if there are more heating events.
You're talking minimum 10 years to get something that might even vaguely resemble what was previously there following a significant bleaching event.
So could this impact the Ningaloo's World Heritage status?
It is definitely a concern because, you know, the coral reef environments are one of the values that gave it its World Heritage status. I don't think we're yet at a point, you know, where we're starting to have to defend its status. You know, Ningaloo has some amazing and incredibly unique attributes to it that make a unique place.
Hack on Triple J.
Jackson Worthington reporting there, and we did ask the WA Environment Minister about concerns the government isn't doing enough to protect Ningaloo. In a response, a government spokesperson said the government acknowledges climate change is the biggest long-term threat to the reef, and that is why it has committed $10 million to the restoration of seagrass and coral in the area. The spokesperson also saying that the government takes UNESCO's serious concern rating seriously and that it will continue rigorous monitoring of the reef. Let's get a bit more into the science now with Dr. James Gilmore from the Australian Institute of Marine Science. Dr. James, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, good afternoon.
We've known bleaching on Ningaloo has been a problem for a while, but just how bad is the situation at the moment?
Well, we're only just starting to understand really the extent of not only the bleaching, but the mortality following the bleaching, because not all corals that bleach do actually die. So these data are coming in now.
And so does that mean some of the bleaching could be reversible? If not all coral dies, is there a way of turning some of it around?
Yeah, absolutely. We do find, particularly in places like Ningaloo that haven't bleached very badly for very many years, that there's certainly the capacity to recover from within by the corals that survive the event and the offspring that they produce. I think the concern here for Ningaloo is that we haven't really had such a severe bleaching ever before.
There's obviously a fair bit of attention on what's been happening on the Great Barrier Reef. Do you think we do need to shift some attention to maybe what's happening on the West Coast as well?
Yeah, I'm obviously a little bit biased in that, being based in Western Australia, but I would say that Western Australia's coral reefs are as diverse and as abundant as they are on the Great Barrier Reef. And in many ways, some of the reefs are still relatively in good condition, and I think we certainly need to switch our attention to the vast expanse of coral reefs on Western Australia.
And are we seeing many other reefs impacted by heat waves, rising temperatures?
I think that's what's most confronting about this year for Western Australia's reefs, and particularly when you combine it with last year for the Great Barrier Reef. This is the first time that over a single event spanning 2 years that we've seen most of Australia's coral reefs affected. So that includes many of the reefs in Western Australia. And again, in terms of the severity, the impact and how widespread it has been, it's certainly the biggest that we've encountered in history.
Are there any concerns to do with tourism? Like, can tourism worsen the impacts at all?
That depends very much on the type of tourism. At the moment, we're really battling much bigger issues with coral bleaching at the moment. But certainly the management that you might underlie the recovery of those reefs following bleaching is influenced by tourism. It might be like the type of fishing activities that go on, or indeed by industry, the type of effects perhaps on water quality that you can see. So it's always important to manage those local conditions while we're trying to battle this much bigger demon of climate heating.
You're listening to Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with Dr. James Gilmore from the Australian Institute of Marine Science, and we're talking about coral bleaching, specifically at Ningaloo, and what is happening there, because there have been some really disturbing reports coming out after studies into coral bleaching on the West Coast. James, what do we need to be doing to minimising the impacts here and stopping coral bleaching?
The actions largely kind of fall into three categories for us, and this kind of doesn't include individuals, but more broadly for organisations and politically, we think by far the most important thing is to mitigate the causes. Like, what are the things that are causing this? And without a doubt, it's carbon emissions causing climate heating, ocean heating, and then the coral bleaching. So we know that we will lose most corals, most coral reefs in coming decades. So we really need to address the causes quickly. The second approach is the one we touched on earlier about just managing local conditions. So certainly if there's good water quality, good fish stocks, and the corals in the reef is healthy apart from that bleaching event, then the recovery is so much faster and better. And then the third one, and the one that's really much riskier and to some extent controversial, is really how much we can intervene with coral reefs, how we can try to find the corals and the coral reefs that are escaping the worst of the pressure, or indeed the corals and the patches of reef that are adapting fastest. And how can we harness that natural adaptation in interventions, whether it's attempts to restore the reef or to try and reduce some of the causes of the mortalities?
Yeah, has there been much success with intervention to this point, James?
There certainly has been success. The problem that we face is just how big that success is and how rapidly it's coming. We even know that corals are actually adapting to climate change, whether it's in the types of communities that you see on the reef or within individual species and their genotypes. But unfortunately, that adaptation just isn't fast enough to keep up with the current rate of heating.
What about artificial reefs? Can they play a role in all of this?
Artificial reefs to date really have been used or investigated in more temperate systems, and particularly to aid with fish stocks. So if you have some structure on the reef, particularly in areas where it might be a sandy bottom, and you create artificial structure, then you'll find a lot of animals and organisms live on and among that, and particularly fish that you might want to catch and eat. It hasn't really been explored that much for coral reefs, and there's a whole issue there in terms of just structural integrity, you know, engineering, but that's still really something we're yet to work out.
And James, can you explain the real impacts of losing these reefs? Because it sounds like that is going to happen, that we are going to be losing a lot of this coral in the decades ahead, whether we like it or not.
I mean, I think all Australians just really relish the marine environment, and it's a part of who we are to some extent. The coral reef and the coral structure obviously produce habitat for a huge number of coral reef fish, and that's fishing, whether it's recreational or commercial. And the big one for Australia is obviously tourism. There's many, many values that the reef holds to different communities and people.
Thank you very much for coming on and having a chat with us about all of that. Dr. James Gilmore from the Australian Institute of Marine Science. Appreciate your time.
Yeah, no, thank you for having me.
Hack. Yes, you best believe the company manufacturing this drug are making a killing.
On Triple J.
There's no doubt weight loss drugs have already had a huge impact on the world, like singers, models, athletes, to everyday people, maybe even you.
taking them, using them on drugs like Wegovy, Mounjaro, others like Ozempic, of course, which isn't made for weight loss but has become synonymous with it. Apart from the physical impacts of these drugs, though, there are also huge financial implications. Like, they're big business. And one of the pharmaceutical companies that makes some of these drugs has recently been valued at more than $1.5 trillion. So how much bigger could it get? Well, Alan Kohler is a finance journalist with the ABC and has written about this today and is with us now to chat about it. Hi, Alan. Thanks for coming on.
Not at all.
How popular are these drugs? Like, do we know how many Australians are taking them?
I looked at a study that was done by UNSW just a little while ago, and it looks like about 200,000 people. Sales have increased tenfold since 2020, so in 5 years.
How profitable are these drugs for the companies who are producing them?
Well, the company that makes Mounjaro and Zepbound, which is Eli Lilly, has just passed $1 trillion US in value, which is why I wrote the article, because that kind of piqued my interest as to what the hell's going on, because all the trillion-dollar companies at the moment are artificial intelligence businesses like NVIDIA and Meta, and they increased their sales to $3.6 billion in the quarter for Mounjaro, and it was an increase of 40%. And look, like a lot of these drugs, they cost cents to make, hardly anything, and hundreds of dollars they sell them for. So the profit margin is huge because they're effectively a monopoly, since they have a patent that lasts for about 10 years. Well, there's four drugs that are on the market at the moment: Mounjaro, Zepbound, Ozempic, and Wegovy. Ozempic and Wegovy are made by Novo Nordisk, and those other two are made by Eli Lilly.
And there's a lot of talk now about what's being called Ozempic 2.0, the next generation of these drugs. Companies obviously banking on that development as well to bring them in some big profits.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, as you'd expect, there's a lot of activity, research activity going on. There's about a dozen companies working on other alternatives. I mean, you need to produce something different to what the current companies are doing in order to get around the patent. But there's a few companies working on tablets, because all these drugs so far, you have to inject them. So there's a few companies are working on tablets. Some companies are working on monthly injections instead of weekly. So look, you know, there's just tons of activity going on, as you'd expect, because this is a very profitable area.
What kind of impact are these drugs having on the way we eat?
Well, there was one US study that I quoted in my article that showed that households with at least one of the members on these medicines reduced their grocery spend by 6% in 6 months. I mean, I don't want to present myself as an expert on these things. It does seem that when you take these drugs, you're less inclined to eat fast foods. You get less hungry, you buy less food, you eat less food. And so it seems inevitable that the more people are on these drugs, the less food people eat and the less fast food. I mean, I think it's bad for McDonald's and KFC and the rest of them. How many people end up on these things? Who knows? But what if it's half the population? I mean, the other thing about these drugs is that they don't just deal with weight loss. They directly improve your heart function and your kidney function. So they're good in other ways. They're not without side effects, obviously. The side effects don't seem to affect everybody, but some people do get nauseous. And the other problem with them is that when you take these drugs, you don't just lose fat. You slim down your muscle and you lose a bit of bone density as well. But when you go off them, you just put on fat. So you can end up back to your old weight once you get off them. You've got less muscle and less bone density.
Are there any calls for them to be made more affordable here in Australia, Alan?
Ozempic has been placed on the PBS for type 2 diabetes treatment only, and it's quite tightly controlled. You know, you've got to have tried other things first, and the clinician needs to ring the PBS hotline to get approval to prescribe it. But that's the beginning. The other things are Mounjaro and Zepbound are quite expensive. I think they're at least $500, maybe $600 a month. Wegovy, which is the other form of Ozempic, is less expensive than that. The trouble with them for the government is that people really need to be on them for life. Otherwise, you know, when you go off it, you put your weight back on again. So the trouble for the government is it's a long-term cost.
Yeah, definitely a lot of stuff to watch in this space. Thank you for coming on and having a chat with us about all this. ABC finance reporter Alan Kohler, appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
And someone on the text line says, Wegovy was suggested to me because I'm classed as morbidly obese, but I don't qualify for the PBS, so it costs me $285 for the script. It's a lot of money.
There's actually some other news on some of these drugs that is out today. Australia's medicines regulator, the TGA, has put out a safety warning over potential risk of suicidal thoughts and behaviours when taking Ozempic-style drugs. Very interesting article, very interesting update. If you want to learn more about it, head to ABC News Online. There's an article now that explains it. So if you're on some of those drugs, definitely worth a read. But that is all for Hack for now.